This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Israeli settlers increase their attacks on Palestinian Christian holy sites. A new report by the Palestinian Policy Network, Al-Shabaka, deconstructs the World Bank's recent recommendations for fixing the Palestinian economy. We'll have an interview with Ala Tartir in Palestine, who co-authored the Al-Shabaka report.
What Palestinians need under occupation, they need a resistance economy. They need an economy that can support them in order to face the occupation and eventually to end the occupation.
Also, more on the Electronic Intifada's exposé of a BBC correspondent who deliberately misrepresents Palestinian voices. Under Israeli pressure, the U.S. cancels scholarships to students in Gaza. News from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as five Arab musical artists pull out of an Austrian festival due to its sponsorship by the Israeli embassy, and a statement by more than 100 Palestinians reaffirms that the struggle for Palestinian rights is incompatible with any form of racism or bigotry. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. Coming up a little later on in the podcast, an interview with Ala Tartir of the Al-Shabaka Palestinian Policy Network on how the World Bank and international donors have helped to de-develop the Palestinian economy while making recommendations to fix it. But first, we begin with these top stories. Gillian Kessler-Damour reported this week that Palestinian Christian leaders are in fear, quote, that a recent increase in attacks on their holy sites signals the potential for future more extreme violence. Moreover, as so-called price tag attacks by fundamentalist right-wing Israeli settler groups continue against Palestinian Muslim and Christian holy sites, including cemeteries and places of worship, the Israeli government has done nothing to investigate and punish those responsible. In her report, Kessler-Damour writes that, quote, a Franciscan monastery on Mount Zion in Jerusalem was vandalized in early October, as derogatory words about Jesus were painted on the entrance gate alongside the words price tag in Hebrew. Price tag violence is the term used to describe acts of vandalism usually carried out by Jewish Israeli settlers in the West Bank, in response to Israeli government decisions with which they disagree. The report adds that suspected Israeli extremists also burned the doors of a monastery in Latrun, halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, in September, and scrawled the words, Jesus is a monkey, on the wall. The attack was likely carried out in connection to a recent evacuation of an illegal Israeli settlement outpost in the West Bank a few days before. Kessler-Damour writes that, quote, more than 90% of complaints filed by Palestinians to the Israeli police in recent years regarding settler violence have been closed without an indictment being filed, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. That was a recap of a report by Gillian Kessler-Damour. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. A new report by Ala Tartir and Jeremy Wildman for the Palestinian Policy Network Al-Shabaka takes a deep look at the role that the World Bank and international donors have had in the de-development of the Palestinian economy. As the Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority continues to press for international donor aid due to a skyrocketing funding crisis, while Israel maintains its military occupation and economic control of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, many Palestinian economists are warning of a disastrous economic collapse. In July, a report by the World Bank entitled Towards Economic Sustainability of a Future Palestinian State, Promoting Private Sector-Led Growth, acknowledged that the Palestinian Authority must dial back its reliance on international aid and recommended that the Israeli government remove suffocating restrictions in order to develop the private sector, something that neoliberalist PA Prime Minister Salam Fayyad has been advocating. However, as Al-Shabaka writes in the executive summary of Tartir and Wildman's report, quote, it is important to understand the extent to which the World Bank's policy advice is largely destined for failure because World Bank recommendations form the basis on which international donors design their aid programs. For much more on this story, we go to Palestine, where we're joined by Ala Tartir. Ala is the program director for Al-Shabaka and joins us from Ramallah. Ala, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Noura, for having me.
So let's talk about the World Bank's findings and why you see it as a failure. And as you wrote in your report, how the World Bank has in fact helped to de-develop the Palestinian economy. Give us an overview of what's been happening here.
Yeah, the World Bank report, which is called the Gross Report, it tried to state the status of the Palestinian economy and provide a description of the obstacles it faces and the major weaknesses and structural distortions that it suffers from. But majorly, it provides a set of policy recommendations that is basically built on an economic model based on export-driven private sector-led growth. And actually, apart from these policy recommendations, the major conclusion and the major frank conclusion we can say of that report is that the achieved economic growth over the last few years in the Palestinian economy is illusionary and unsustainable. And precisely, it occurred because of international aid, and it was aid-driven, and that make it unsustainable. So that was the frank conclusion. However, also at the same time, the report provide a number of policy recommendations that actually are quite irrelevant in many aspects, and mainly intentionally or unintentionally try to decontextualize the whole set of recommendations and provide irrelevant and decontextualized policy recommendations. And a major problem with the World Bank and its policies over the decades, over this 20 years since Oslo, is that until today, the bank and the major international donors are still stuck, actually, in the era of Oslo. And they still deal with the occupied Palestinian territory as a post-conflict context. And that in itself has a number of problems that the set of policy recommendations is actually not very suitable, because the status of the occupied Palestinian territory is continuous occupation and it is an in-conflict situation. So at the general framework, there is a problem in the overall framework. However, the additional problem with the World Bank that it minimizes the meaning of the occupation, and in that sense, it really does not go to the root causes of the problem and addressing that the occupation so clearly and so explicitly is the problem there. So it is a way that the World Bank and other international donor community remain maneuvering around the problem, actually, and never address the root cause of the problem. And they use very nice words and really with soft meanings to describe the occupation, like restrictions. And restrictions by any way does not equal occupation. If we dig more into the details of these set of recommendations, the most striking one was actually is that the World Bank asked the Palestinians to imitate and emulate the Asian Tigers model, which is quite a ridiculous suggestion, actually, because the major pillars and the major preconditions to achieve an economic growth as the Asian Tigers is really not there. And by all means, they are asking the Palestinian Authority to do so. And all of us as observers and Palestinian citizens, we know very well that the space of maneuvering for the Palestinian Authority in the policy arena is really very, very limited to maneuver within. And then they are asking the Palestinian Authority to do something that they really can't, and that the Palestinian Authority find themselves, and actually they found themselves since 20 years, forced to do it, and they accept it now, and now they are promoting it here and there. But this high level of expectation from an authority that does not have any sovereignty or control on borders, or if they are talking about exports, so it's really, really problematic. The other difficult and strange, actually, recommendation is that the World Bank asked the Palestinians to provide one of the best business environment, business-friendly environment in the world, not only regionally or locally. So they, in a way, they're asking an economy under occupation to perform excellent and give lots of incentives for investments and be a good and friendly environment for businesses, while they are completely, completely ignoring the fact on the ground. And that is the major point. They totally dismiss facts on the ground, and they totally dismiss the historical policies that the government of Israel followed over the last many, many, many years.
That's the voice of Ala Tartir. He works for Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, and joins us from Ramallah in the West Bank. Ala, talk about what you found are really the sustainable building blocks to construct a sound Palestinian economy. What are the first steps, and what is the role of basic human rights in this equation?
Well, I think the first steps will be a complete change and a complete shift in the development paradigm that we have in the occupied Palestinian territory. It is the time to change the whole mentality and to change the whole way development is perceived, and therefore to reform and rethink the international aid industry in Palestine. That is really a must step that we need to follow in order to go back actually to the basics in a way, and go back to the first square and think that what Palestinians need under occupation, they need a resistance economy. They need an economy that can support them in order to face the occupation and eventually to end the occupation. It's time to change the way that the Palestinian Authority think about the development process, and along, of course, with the international community, and shift from understanding the development process in its very technical nature towards understanding the development process as freedom, actually, and towards understanding it as a human, the basic human right need as well to develop, and the right for the Palestinian to develop. So it starts at the policy and perception level that the policymakers need to change. The neoliberal agenda is definitely not something new to the Palestinian life, if you want. But and definitely when we say neoliberalism in Palestine, it has also a Palestinian flavor in it. Because since the establishment of the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian Authority adopted a free market economic system. And this implies a deep role for international organizations such as the World Bank and IMF. And since then, we have the Washington Consensus and post-Washington Consensus policy prescriptions. These policies indeed entrenched since 2007 with the arrival of Prime Minister Salam Fayyad. And then Palestinians actually start to be referred to as one of the star examples of success stories after adopting neoliberal agenda. However, the facts on the ground is contradicting such perceptions by the international community, and they measure this success by the level of economic growth. However, actually, the major problem between the Palestinian elite and the neoliberal policies and the facts on the ground and the civil society voices is actually the legitimacy gap, first of all. There is a huge legitimacy gap that the Palestinian elite suffers from. And this is indeed reflected, of course, on the way that people perceive the economic policies. And this is actually After a few years, after 5 years of adopting a very strict and harsh neoliberal agenda, now we witness the results, which is not coming, definitely, it's not coming as a surprise, since we all saw what such neoliberal agenda did in other parts of the world, and in that sense, Palestine will not be an exception. And over the last few weeks, we've seen people in the streets protesting against the Palestinian Authority neoliberal agenda and approaches. And this divide is widening. And particularly if you really were attached to the ground and able to see the human suffering that the Palestinians suffer from, you can see that there is a huge, that these policies, the neoliberal economic policies, created a massive gap between the people and created a huge inequality gap between between the rich and the poor, to the extent that is really widening for this first time in the Palestinian society, that you can easily hear in the streets that there is no middle class. Either you become a rich or this is a poor. And this is actually a very expected and unsurprising result for such neoliberal agenda. And because of that, we're calling to revisit such agenda for its negative consequences on the society and its social contracts and cohesion and its multiple impact on the Palestinian people's ability to struggle against the occupation.
All right, well, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Alaa Tartir. He is the program director for Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, and has been speaking to us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Alaa, thank you so much for all of your work. And if people want to see more of this report that you co-authored with Jeremy Waldeman, it's called Persistent Failure, World Bank Policies for the Occupied Palestinian Territories, and can be accessed on the ashabaka.org website or through my blog on the Electronic Intifada. Alaa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
An investigation by reporter Asa Wynn-Stanley for the Electronic Intifada this week found that a freelance journalist who works for the BBC once depicted a Palestinian known for collaboration with Israel as the founder of a peace group. In a 2002 Washington Times article, journalist Paul Martin interviewed Zoher Hamdan, describing him as the, quote, founder of the Movement for Coexistence in Jerusalem, who was attacked by, quote, a criminal gang that supposedly imposed a 2-year reign of terror on other Palestinians in Bethlehem. But a recent Israeli court document describes Hamdan as once claiming to have had a position, quote, in the Ministry of Defense. The Israeli media has described him as, quote, a proud collaborator, and reported that he and his family are legally armed, and noted accusations in his hometown that he works for Israel's secret police, also known as Shin Bet or Shabak. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. Ali Abunima wrote this week on the Rights and Accountability blog section that, quote, in another example of the Obama administration's pandering to Israel and collusion with it to collectively punish Palestinians, the U.S. has again canceled a scholarship program for students in Gaza. The Associated Press reported that, quote, Amal Ashour, 18 years old, loves Shakespeare and American pop music. One of the brightest students in the Gaza Strip, she studied her senior year of high school in Minnesota through a U.S. government-funded program. She had planned to study English literature this fall at a university in the West Bank through another U.S.-sponsored program, but just a month before school started, she was informed the scholarship was no longer available. Abunima posted more of the AP story, which explained that under direct Israeli pressure, the U.S., quote, quietly canceled the 2-year-old scholarship program for, quote, promising but financially challenged Palestinian high school seniors from Gaza and the West Bank to study in local Palestinian universities. The program was launched with media fanfare from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Abunima added in his blog post that, quote, the move by the Obama administration to cancel the Gaza scholarships under Israeli pressure is only the latest move in Israel's unrelenting war on Palestinians' right to education. That Israel has a complete veto on the entry and exit of Gaza students also demonstrates the extent to which Israel, the occupying power, controls Gaza. It is in this context where Israel thwarts Palestinian education from the earliest age through university that Palestinian civil society's calls for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions must be seen. Those were excerpts from Ali Abonima's post in our Rights and Accountability blog section. To read more, visit electronicintifada.net. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that as of Thursday, five Arab artists have pulled out of the Salam Orient 2012 music festival in Austria because of sponsorship by the Israeli embassy. Vienna-based Palestinian singer, composer, and musician Marwan Abado, Syrian singer Lena Chamamian, Lebanese MC Malaika, and Palestine's DJ Sotu Sura and MC Boycott announced that they were withdrawing from the festival in the past week. Despite assertions by the Salam Orient Festival directors that the Israeli embassy has no influence on the program, the festival's website displays the Israeli embassy's logo. The embassy is directly sponsoring one of the acts, providing the musicians who live in Israel with transportation and lodging costs during their performance at the festival. The Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, or PACB, calls on artists around the world to boycott events sponsored by the Israeli government and in other circumstances that it sets out in its guidelines as part of the global movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions aimed at pressuring Israel to respect Palestinian human rights. For more on this story and other important news from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, go to electronicintifada.net and check out our activism and BDS section. And finally, a statement was signed by 116 Palestinians living in historic Palestine and in the diaspora this past week in, quote, the spirit of past statements and in light of recent controversies that, quote, reaffirms a key principle of our movement for freedom, justice, and equality. The struggle for our inalienable rights is one opposed to all forms of racism and bigotry, including but not limited to anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, Zionism, and other forms of bigotry directed at anyone, and in particular people of color and indigenous peoples everywhere. The statement adds, quote, we oppose the cynical and baseless use of the term anti-Semitism as a tool for stifling criticism of Israel or opposition to Zionism, as this assumes simply because someone is Jewish, they support Zionism or the colonial and apartheid policies of the State of Israel, a false generalization. Our struggle is anchored in universal human rights and international law in opposition to military occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid, something people of conscience of all ethnicities, races, and religions can support. Finally, we call on people around the world to join us in a morally consistent stance that opposes racism and bigotry in all forms. An ethical struggle for justice and equal rights in any context entails zero tolerance for racial discrimination and racism anywhere. That was the text of a statement signed this week by 116 Palestinians in Palestine and around the world. To see the full list of signatories, visit electronicintifada.net in our activism and BDS section. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our news features, including Rami Al-Megari's report on Palestinians facing restrictions on internet freedoms in Gaza, an op-ed by students in Arizona who unite struggles by Latinos and indigenous peoples in North America with Palestinians. Omar Barghouti says that the European Union's support for Israeli crimes makes it unworthy of a Nobel Peace Prize. Joe Catrone interviews a former prisoner 1 year after he was forcibly transferred to Gaza during the prisoner swap deal, exclusive film and art reviews, and so much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.